The CEO of the Public Health Association of Australia. So just a tiny little bit of background before I introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Philip James. The Public Health Association of Australia has been going from strength to strength, and we have been getting more and more involved in the food and nutrition debate. And this is causing some anguish for industry and some others, and we think that's a good thing. But we do it in a way where we make sure that we are working with the Cancer Council, the Heart Foundation, Dietitian Association, a big, a broadest range of people we can, as anybody who's studied health promotion and so forth knows you should do. What we decided to do was to try and take a lead in attempting to get governments to look at food policy and saying it's not just about health, because as soon as you actually push the health area in food policy, somebody in government's going, yes, but agriculture needs to be protected. What about imports? How much money is involved? Look at all those jobs. And so we said what we really need is a comprehensive policy, and we looked around the as we got the conference underway, and I have to say a big thank you to Queensland Government, who was the first one to come up with a major sponsorship package for us, and the Queensland Department of Health. And we looked around, and the Scientific Committee Chair, Professor Heather Yateman from Wollongong University, suggested that we should bring Philip James to Australia, because actually he's done all those things. And not only has he done those things in Britain, but also in Europe with the World Health Organization and so forth. You know, Philip has a CBE, an honour with the British Empire, and the thing that amazes me is that he actually doesn't have one of the world versions, because when I've heard him speak, as I've travelled with him over the last week, and know the impact that he's had right across the world, I think that should happen. And so in a very short while, I'm going to introduce him. I haven't even introduced him yet. I'm getting to that. But what I would like to do is say that it's actually not too late to book into our Food Futures Conference next week, although I don't expect anybody to do that if you haven't already. But there is a Queensland branch Public Health Association Living Well Conference that's on the 19th and 20th of July. And you'll find that, I think, through our website, am I right? You can find the, or there, and you've got information here as well. There's information here about that, and abstracts should be submitted just after Anzac Day weekend. And I'm sure it will be excellent if it compares at all to the one that I attended last year. One other thing before I start. Public Health Association the board has just decided to reduce the fees, because the fees of the Public Health Association have actually been quite expensive. They've been brought down very substantially, and the details of them are there. We actually set about to do advocacy work, and that's why Philip and I have just been speaking to the Deputy Premier and the Parliamentary Secretary in Health, and we've done that around Australia, and we continue to do that sort of work to persuade the governments what they should be doing about health. And if you go onto the Public Health Association website, you will see just how active we've been in the media and in working with the governments and crossbenchers and oppositions and all of those sorts of things that we do as part of our advocacy work. It works so much better when we have more members to be also doing the same thing. So that's my little plug for our membership, and thank you for putting it with me, letting me do that. Philip is really a world-leading professor on the issues of food and nutrition. He has a medical background, but he's actually also worked in agriculture for maybe 17 years, or I'm in the right order, where he was running an agricultural institute. So actually he's looked at things from a whole range of perspectives, and I think that's why it is that he's so sought after by places like the World Health Organization, the European community, and the work in the United Kingdom. I think that I know that you are going to enjoy what he has to say. Please, Professor James.
Do I need to turn anything on in terms of recording
for you? No, it's already recording.
Recording, okay. I've been told that everything I'll be telling you is recorded so that a bunch of lawyers can start the actions against me. I was told some time ago by the BBC never to say anything in public or private where I couldn't defend a single sentence for 6 weeks in the High Court. So I'm intimidated by that, but I've also discovered that you're all professionals, whereas I understood, perhaps I got a sense that there might be members of the public. So I'm going to change what I'm going to say to you on the basis that you're highly professional. Delighted to be back in Brisbane. Michael's taken most of the stuff that I need to tell you, really. But I thought it would be quite helpful, because you're going to find, if you're dealing with the political classes or indeed the medical profession, that, as always, you're going to have your critics. And one of the constant criticisms is that this nonsense about obesity and the AIDS epidemic, which I'll come to shortly, is a problem of misclassification. And this mysterious body mass index, and I'm going to assume that you all know about that, that's hopelessly crude. The answer is, yes, it is crude. And we came up with the standards, original standards, in 1972, based on pre-Second World War U.S. insurance statistics for people who took out voluntarily insurance policies and were tracked. And for men and women, we worked out and we rounded it up on John Garrett's advice to a BMI of 25. And actually, when you look at it, it's quite interesting, because men are at the top, and you see this curve, U-shaped curve. The fact that it goes up lower down is a matter of big debate, and it's probably relating to smoking and other people who actually have a higher death rate, because there's something there still undiagnosed, and so on. But in fact, if you look, you're well on the way up by the time you get to BMI 30. So this is now, you can't see it, 900,000 people from brilliant analysis of a huge set of cohorts. I think it's 57 cohorts, published in The Lancet last year. So the criteria are based on deaths, and that's important, because we need to actually think about things in a slightly different way. So if you take that, and it's a valid set of criteria on mortality, and then you take the criteria that we developed for children, we can have a wonderful debate about the latest WHO criteria. Read the Pediatrics recent edition, where Tim Lobstein and I take the WHO apart. We don't think our IATF criteria are necessarily fine, but we'll come to that. This epidemic, and I decide why not show Australia. If it's one of you who's produced this on the left, it is totally fabulous, because it tells the story, of course, that it took off essentially in 85. And if you go around the world, crudely speaking, in developing countries it takes off only five years later. And on the right, I've just put in the latest report, the Preventative Task Force's collation of, albeit crude, adult statistics. And it's rather surprising, because with adults, certainly in Western Europe, it starts about 1980 to take off. But, I mean, it's skyrocketing. Now, if you go and say what's happening around the world, here are our latest, I think still unpublished data, or in press, I can never remember, where we look at the different WHO regions. And in each of those regions, and I've taken women deliberately, roughly the same applies to men. If you look at the sequence of five blocks, that is going from 18-year-olds up to 70-plus-year-olds. And the red, which is the obesity prevalence, you notice stacks up progressively. In other words, from 18 to 29, you already have a problem of obesity in red and overweight in blue. And it actually progressively goes up in every single region of the world during a time when traditionally we don't think it's terribly important. And we actually knew this 30 years ago, that did you know the worst thing that a woman can do is to go to live with a man, because that's when their weight particularly starts to go up. And the worst thing a man can do, the only good thing he can do is, of course, to go and live with a woman. But the terrible thing is when he gives up sport. So you find that actually men have a somewhat delayed kick. At least that's the beautiful study from the Netherlands. And so the question is, why do people put on weight when they get older? And here's the most gorgeous study, the Baltimore Aging Study, that I recalculated 100 years ago, where actually if you look at the individuals, the same individuals, same men, studied when they're 25 years of age and 70 years of age, and the most fabulous analyses. And I've stacked up our original way of displaying how much energy you use. And these men, by definition, were at constant weight at the time. And clearly they were eating 3,100 calories, okay? They were expending 3,100 calories. And you can see what they were. Intense exercise, in other words, playing rugby. Discretionary, in other words, they were civilized. They took their girlfriends for a dance. They actually had to occasionally to do some work at the age of 25. And then if they were sitting and fiddling, if they drank a cup of coffee, which we showed increases metabolic rate, or smoking, which we also showed increased metabolic rate, that's another increment. And if they ate, they had to eat to get the 3,100. 10% of that is just burn. Now, take those same men, how many years later? 45 years later. And look at the incredible collapse. Why? Because they're no longer working. They've even given up rugby. And so they're actually only eating and expending 2,000 calories. So actually, there's something mysterious that they automatically, in some way, if they have stayed the same weight, have reduced their intake, unconsciously, by over 1,000 calories. Well, hang on, this is me, I would tell you. On the left, pretty busy fella. Oh, doesn't it come through? Isn't that amazing? I knew this computer wouldn't work. 3,000 calories at the top. That's where that arrow starts. And because I became vaguely successful, I actually gave up running around the wards and took up using computers and things. And I dropped my energy expenditure by 500 calories. But I continued to eat. Well, I mean, you know, everything was organized for me, and I ate the same food because I thought that's reasonable. The only way I could eat that same amount of food with reduced energy expenditure was to gain weight from 70 to 80 kilograms until my basal metabolic rate had gone up and the weight, the cost, energy cost of activity, the two of those had combined so that I was now burning at 85 kilos, the same 3,000 calories I was burning much earlier. Fine. You dietitians, nutritionists, are there any in the room? You just tell everybody, you know, lose weight for God's sake. And I used to say that to my obese patients, and a few of them were stupid enough to agree. And they came straight down to normal. And I put them into complete agony. They went, despite having 500,000 extra calories on board, they went to instant metabolic shock with semi-starvation syndrome, with drops in their thyroid within 48 hours, that their sympathetic nervous system shut down, their automatic nervous system went up, their metabolic rate started dropping and came down to the same as seen in semi-starvation studies with men losing huge amounts, and they progressively were desperate to eat. And the people who I called the post-obese could only survive by being obsessive about increasing their exercise, watching every calorie that went in, to keep their weight down, because we slowly now discover that there's a major, and it looks as though it's a physical neuronal adaptation in the post-hypothalamic leptin area, which actually keeps people, having put on weight slowly over 20 years, it locks in the brain to prevent weight loss. Hence the epidemic, despite all of us swearing at people and telling them to buck up, take individual responsibility, and so on. That is a fundamental problem that we haven't yet confronted properly. There is very good evidence for it, and animal experiments too, which we could come to. Okay, so now there's an epidemic going on. But what about this genetic stuff? Clearly genetics can't account for the epidemic, because it's happened since 1980. But the evidence really is pretty profoundly coherent, that between 50 and 75% of the inter-individual variance within any one society is genetically related. It's not genetics absolute, but it's the genetic interaction in terms of food intake with particular dietary components or with physical activity. You don't believe that? So here's my old friend Bouchard's studies on monozygotic twins. And he feeds these pairs of twins exactly the same extra calories, stuffs them with 800 calories a day. I think it was for 100 days. And over on the left, that line is the range of change in body weight of twin B on the bottom. The remarkable thing is that one twin B gains 12 kilos. Another twin B, a different twin, gains only 4 under the same overfeeding study. Everything was monitored, absolutely everything, but there was astonishing difference in weight gain. However, the blob shows you where twin A was as well. And actually twin A, in each pair of twins, performed in exactly the same way, but differed markedly between those twin pairs. Huge. And the same is true in weight loss. In other words, there's something mysterious and we haven't a clue what we're talking about. But it now is getting really exciting, and I could have spent an hour talking about the neuronal system. You're all in public health, so this is all nonsense. No, it's not nonsense at all. Because people discovered leptin, Friedman discovered leptin, and everything, and ghrelin is of enormous importance, and the PYY, these lock-in systems, are they really relevant? Well, the most beautiful example comes from Cambridge in England, where Steve O'Reilly's team had some children with leptin deficiency. And this poor lad was offered breakfast, and he was allowed any amount of breakfast he wanted. And he usually ate 4,800 calories at breakfast, and half an hour later started eating again. They discovered that he didn't have any leptin in his blood. They then put in a drip of leptin to get it up to physiological levels, and within 48 hours at breakfast, the 4,800 calories going in was now 800 calories. Didn't feel hungry. And actually they've done a whole series of beautiful studies on different receptors and shown that you can monitor the physiological relationship, and it actually, you can explain it in the same terms, their response, in terms of the volume and calories in breakfast. So, contrary to popular belief, our food intake system and our energy expenditure is fantastically controlled. We showed in the calorimeters, when I and others went in, that the coefficient of variation of our body machine is so brilliantly controlled, it's less than 1% variation from day to day, from month to month. Unless you're a woman during the menstrual cycle, and you have the most amazing coherent cycling of both food intake and energy metabolism, and you lock into a roughly steady state over a 28-30 day period. Quite incredible. Controlled. And yet we think, well, you know, it's all to do with what I like to eat and so on. Well, nonsense.